This way, walk.
The following is a previously broadcast program.
There is this thing. Do you realize
what is?
There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
Welcome to the Friday edition of CKUT's community news program, Off the Hour. Today is June 25th. My name is Brian Jefferson, and I will be your host today. CKUT broadcasts from the unceded traditional territory of the Anishinaabeg and the Kanyankahaga, one of the founding nations of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy. Stay tuned, we'll be right back with some news on CKUT 90.3 FM.
For
cauliflower,
confusion, creation,
pickle, K for
kitten,
camp,
see, wait, Fianro, see, U, unbearable,
U is for underground,
oh, yeah,
umbrella,
T, trite,
tremendous,
torment,
tire,
C, K,
I can't think of a U one,
T,
F is for famous,
fun, fumble, M is for Montreal.
But first, some news. Quebec is reporting 88 COVID-19 cases today. It's 4 more cases than June 21st, when the province saw its lowest daily total since August 2020. All Quebec regions will enter a green zone on Monday. This means more restrictions will ease and a maximum of 10 people will be able to gather indoors or 20 people outside. And a new group of retired police officers and unspecified community organizers want to reform police training nationwide. The Canadian Coalition for Police Reform, or the CCPR, was created this month. They say they want police certification processes to be longer, to be standardized, and to include de-escalation training. Montreal groups have been calling for the gradual abolition and defunding of the city's police force since June 2020. Last week, Radio Canada released citizen footage of a Montreal police officer kneeling on the neck of a 14-year-old boy from Villeray who was black. The Mohawk Council of Kenewaugi have also released a statement this week about B-218. The federal bill passed this week, and it legalizes single-event sports gambling. Kenewaugi's council says the bill hampers its local sports betting industry. It said it's disgusted and dismayed that senators ignored its concerns. And the Cowessess First Nation in Saskatchewan announced this week that they have found more unmarked graves at a former residential school. The remains of 751 children have been found at the former medieval Indian residential school. Khalsa's chief, Cadmus Delormier, says they're now trying to find families and names of all the children. This comes only weeks after 215 children were found at another former residential school in Kamloops. Montrealers gathered after that discovery to mourn together and encourage more digging. A national Indian residential school crisis hotline is operating 24 hours a day at 1-866-925-4419 for anyone who needs support. Here's Chief Delormier on Thursday.
And we will know more as we continue our research. Again, to the ones that are listening that have went to residential school, that are descendants of residential school survivors, there are numbers available for you to call, and you are not alone. At this time, I just wanted to give a moment for our knowledge keeper, Florence Barvier, to come and share a few words before Chief Bobby Cameron.
Florence? I'm 80 years old, and I went to boarding school down there. I was taken by my parents to go. At that time, if the parents didn't want to allow their children to go to boarding school, one of them had to go to jail. So in order that we keep the family together, we went to boarding school. They brought us there. We stayed there. And we learned, they pounded it into us. And really, they were very mean. When I say pounding, I mean pounding. Those nuns were very mean to us. I don't know, I don't think they liked it being there either. But we had to learn how to be Roman Catholic. We couldn't say our own little blessings the way we said it at home. We had our own way of honoring ourselves and Mother Earth in our own homes when we were little, but we had to leave all that after. So when we were taught at home that we had to look after ourselves physically, mental, emotionally, and spiritual. So that got all stripped away when we went to boarding school. They told us what to say. They told us about a new being that was supposed to be our ultimate savior. But the ones we had in our school, they were not nice either. They were very condemning about our people. They told us our people, our parents and grandparents had no they didn't have a way to be spiritual because we were all heathens. And this was, I was the third one in my family that went to that school. My grandmother went and my mother and me. So they were still teaching that all the time. So they were putting us down as a people. So we learned how to not like who we were. And that has gone on and on, and it's still going on, because we couldn't teach our people, our own families, how to look after themselves physically, mental, emotionally, and spiritual. They made us, when we became assimilated, they made us think different and feel different. So it's a lot of the pain that we see in our people right now comes from there. Mm-hmm. So And I went to another school at Lebret also. And that was the same thing. You know, they had, they made us believe we didn't have souls. Both places. And that was the ultimate desire of all of us to, how can we be better, do better? And sometimes it's really hard to know. And how our parents had, our parents and grandparents had a hard life because they were had to be assimilated. So now we know how to do that. We don't have to go back. We just have to learn how to look after ourselves in a good way. So I thank you, Chief, for allowing me to come here and talk a little bit about it. I'm an elder on the reserve. I have a sweat lodge. I stopped it now because I want somebody else to do it. But if you need an elder, you know, people want to come, they can come. I have a lodge. My husband had built me a little lodge, so that's where I see people. I don't tell them anything. I don't tell anyone who's there, but I'm busy. Thank you.
Back to you, Larissa. Thank you, Florence.
Thank you very much, Chief. We will now have Chief Bobby Cameron. This is FSIN Chief Bobby Cameron. He is the Chief of the Federation of Sovereign Indigenous Nations, which represents the 74 First Nations in Saskatchewan. Chief, whenever you're ready.
Yeah, good morning. I want to say Tanchen Wagomagantik. Nigan Mantu Kanashkuman Miyogisagal Megwats. Megwat no kum no. Go kum no. First and foremost, to our God, our Creator, for a beautiful day today. To our Nokum, our Knowledge Keeper, our Elder, for the opening prayer, thank you. Chief Cadmus and your community, for the challenging work that you have just completed. We are grateful and thankful in our prayers, teaching every one of your families there in Cowessess. And to all that are on the line, that are listening, you have important work to do in terms of getting the message out there for the world to understand what we First Nations have endured for many, many decades within the residential school era, the 60s school, the day schools, and currently in the child welfare system, where there has to be and must be immediate change, where our First Nation children come home to our communities and be raised in our communities amongst our own language and culture experts. This was a crime against humanity, an assault on First Nation people. We are proud people. The only crime we ever committed as children was being born Indigenous. A lot of work, a lot of healing will take place. And there are many sites that we're going to be doing this similar work, and we will find more. So we ask for each and every one of you to continue to work with us, to continue to pray for us. We call on all levels of government to work with us, and which they are. But in terms of the healing and the aftermath of moving forward for our survivors and descendants, what are the expectations and what are the outcomes? I would also like to say this on behalf of the Federation of Sovereign Indigenous Nations, that we pray for all of these children, their families, and the community of Cowessess. To all our First Nation people, please take care of yourself. Please take care of each other. We are seeing the results of the genocide that Canada committed here. Genocide on our treaty lands. We will find more bodies, and we will not stop until we find all of our children. We will do a search of every Indian residential school site, and we won't stop there. We will also search all of the sanatoriums, the Indian hospitals, and all of the sites where our people were taken and abused, tortured, neglected, and murdered. We will tell the stories of our children, of our people who died, who were killed by the state, by the churches, and we won't stop until we locate all of them. The world is watching Canada as we unearth the findings of genocide. We had concentration camps here. We had them here in Canada, in Saskatchewan. They were called Indian residential schools. Canada will be known as a nation who tried to exterminate the First Nations. Now we have evidence. Evidence of what the survivors of the Indian residential schools have been saying all along for decades, that they were treated without humanity. They were treated, they were tortured, they were abused, and they seen their classmates die. They even had to dig graves for their own fellow students. Can you imagine that? These stories will come out. Canada will have to work with us in the spirit of reconciliation. Prime Minister Trudeau, Premier Scott Moe have committed to doing this. And we will go the distance on this. We expect and demand a full public independent inquiry into the genocide. We need to verify causes of death and identify these children. Our people deserve more than apologies and sympathies, which we are grateful for. Our people deserve justice. Canada can start by handing over all of those records. The churches can start by handing over all of those records. To all of our allies, we need support as we grieve. This is just the beginning of the number of children who will be found. As I mentioned earlier, we won't stop until we find them all. I want to say this on a lasting note. We try to put ourselves in the eyes and the bodies of these children who are now being found in the ground, who have been waiting for decades to have a proper burial and to be honored properly amongst their own protocols, traditions, and customs. And a small First Nations voice said, "They found us. They found us." Thank you for listening to me this morning.
Again, the National Indian Residential School Crisis Hotline for anyone needing emotional support is at 1-866-925-441. Some municipalities have announced that they will not be marking upcoming Canada Day celebrations this year. Cities like Burnaby and Victoria say they won't mark the holiday because of the ongoing and unfolding news about Canada's colonial history of genocide and the enduring effects of its residential school system. CKUT has reached out to the City of Montreal to ask if it will follow suit, and media representatives have not responded in time for the deadline. Quebec Premier Legault has not commented on Canada Day, but said no this week to calls to make June 21st Indigenous Peoples Day.
Vaccination against COVID-19 is ongoing throughout Quebec. The combined effect of two doses ensures better efficacy of the vaccine, reducing the risk of getting and transmitting the virus. You'll also stay protected for a longer period of time. Coming to your appointment for the second dose of the vaccine is a must, whatever else is on your schedule. The second dose of vaccine is essential. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
CKUT Radio.
Radio.
Sound waves in the air.
CKUT.
Montreal, Canada.
CKUT.
Welcome back to CKUT's Friday Off the Hour. The time is just after 5 p.m. My name is Brian Jefferson. Up first on this episode of Off the Hour, Sarah Jesmer talks with anti-gentrification group Cour de Lille.
Montreal unveiled an action plan last week for Chinatown, a historic borough of the city.
tenants and business owners described a multi-punch of COVID, economic hardship, racism towards Chinese neighbors during the pandemic, and gentrification. Developers have been buying property on the old streets, and Chinatown's residents have asked the city to step in. Some say the city's June 18th action plan does nothing to address gentrification in the area. Chinatown's story is unique to itself, but gentrification is something that many neighborhoods have been staring down for years now as Montreal property values rise. So much so that a group called Cour de Lille, an anti-gentrification group and anti-capitalist group, was created to find longer-term solutions to save boroughs that are rapidly changing in a housing crisis.
My name is Carl Bistrom, and I am an organizer with the Groupe de Recherche Anti-Gentrification Cœur de Lille. And I am active with Verdun Centre contre la Gentrification as well.
They said they came to this work because, like Chinatown, rents in their neighborhoods of St. Henry and Verdun were rising in a way that pushed out people who called it home.
I recently moved back to Montreal from my folks' place. I took a year off from living in St. Henry. And St. Henry saw a pretty giant wave of gentrification over the course of quite a few years. And so I saw the community that I'd kind of like grown up with, around Concordia art students and musicians and all these kinds of like punks and artists were slowly pushed out of the neighborhood to make way for, more new restaurants, more kind of like trendy institutions, and slowly all the kind of like old neighborhood institutions that I liked kind of shut their doors. And I saw the character of the neighborhood really change. And people, it kind of like felt very different. But people around me maybe didn't have a very finely kind of tuned analysis of it. I had a lot of problems with my old landlady, but I didn't really connect that to what was going on, or maybe didn't politicize it quite the same way. Quite a few people I ended up getting to know that were like more politicized did end up trying to, stage occupations, for example, and do different things around in the neighborhood. And I was aware of like different kind of like, resistance activities, I guess, in St. Henry that people talked about in terms of like trying to stop this wave of kind of like speculation and expulsions and like evictions and, kind of this changing thing where suddenly all these rich people are in your neighborhoods and you don't really know what to do. And obviously these tactics were only so useful, right? Like the neighborhood really did change. And I didn't get to keep my old cheap apartment. I ended up moving to Verdun and getting in Verdun on a lease transfer. And it was my friend who worked in housing that had helped me find this apartment. So when I moved to Verdun, I realized like, oh, Verdun is actually undergoing pretty much the same changes, right, as I saw St. Henry go through. And throughout that year I took off, I really sat down and I tried to do a little bit more reading and a little bit more thinking about the way I'd seen leftist groups kind of organize around the city. And I tried to like try and reflect a little bit on like what had happened, basically. And so like joining Verdun Ensemble contre la Gentrification was like a really exciting time for me. This group has had like a lot of successes and a lot of like kind of like political perspectives and like kind of like this kind of like grassroots organizing activities that like really allowed me to like feel more at home in the neighborhood, having kind of like moved there on a lease transfer again, and to kind of like understand what was happening a little bit more finally. And then I also me and my friends who were maybe in other parts of the city, right, founded Cœur de Lille, which was kind of another anti-gentrification group that has a more kind of like pan-Montreal optic to it. And so that was, a really exciting initiative, in my opinion. And hopefully, you know, we can kind of like put forward that gentrification isn't just this kind of like culture war kind of thing where the character of the neighborhood is changing, or like when you're suddenly seeing all these people walking around in the neighborhood where you're like, oh, it's, you know, like suddenly all these yuppies are here. But that it's actually like this process of investment and disinvestment and like speculation in housing. And it has to do with landlords, right? Like it's not just like yuppies, but actually about like a class of landlords in the city that kind of make money off gentrification. And that it has like kind of like these kind of like deeper economic and political ramifications. And I think like understanding the kind of political economy process of gentrification seemed to be a surprise for some people, which seems a little bit silly. But it's important to kind of like think about the ways that, you know, like a shortage of affordable housing has like all these kinds of like really deep, deep repercussions on society, right? Like if rents go up, people have to work more, people get locked into abusive relationships. There's a lot less kind of like mobility for people. It exposes people to a lot more kind of abuse from their landlords because they're more likely to get locked in the leases where they already are. It means that people have less spare time. And so like the like flourishing kind of like art scenes that I really enjoyed in Montreal were only like kind of possible to maintain because we had cheap rent. I think, you know, it's also understanding that like the how expensive rent is proportional also to like what people's incomes are. So in Montreal, the fact that rents doubled, but like salaries didn't really go up means that, you know, people need to work roughly twice as much, right? Mm-hmm. I guess like trying to like politicize some of that understanding and also thinking like, okay, well, people's relationship to other tenants and to their landlords is kind of quite political, and that we need to be trying to organize under that optic, right? I think also it's like the threat of homelessness is pretty much like the most coercive part of like forcing people to work under capitalism, right? Like it's like that's the fear, is that if you don't make enough for rent money, you'll be kicked out. And it forces people to accept really coercive work conditions because of that. And I think we really saw that during the pandemic, right? Like where there was some relief, but like for some people, it wasn't necessarily enough to cover the rent. And then they're forced to go back to work, even if that's dangerous. So we like, I think it's kind of like understanding that all these issues are actually very in like, they're very intimately kind of related to each other. It's not like housing and minimum wage and fighting against homelessness and fighting against sexism are like these completely different things. So I guess like when I wanted to organize the assembly and the town hall, I really wanted to talk to different groups across the city that kind of like shared this understanding, and to maybe like make links between, for example, like the shelters and the anti-gentrification groups, which seemed like really important to me. Another thing I guess I'll mention with the shelter system is I remember talking to a friend who worked at a shelter who mentioned that, you know, often homeowners would block shelters from being built in the neighborhood because it would make property prices go down, right? So it's like a lot of like the idea of like the poor people as kind of like undesirables comes with like these exploding kind of property prices, right? Like these kind of social attitudes get cultivated by speculation in the housing market. Another thing I'd stress is that social housing isn't being invested in, and that we have huge waiting lists for social housing that mean that there effectively isn't a safety net for working families, where life is just kind of getting worse in this way. And I don't think that's something that's inevitable, but I think that's something that's actually happening in part because of the crisis, right? That there's a bit of you know, if you think about like a, you know, Naomi Klein's famous book, The Shock Doctrine, you know, I don't agree with everything in that book, but there is something about, you know, disaster capitalism of like often like when there is a catastrophe, it comes with this kind of like speculation on how to make money from this catastrophe in a kind of extractive way. And I think that's kind of what we saw happen in the housing market in Montreal during the pandemic, which again, like, housing prices have completely soared in Montreal, and they haven't soared in other cities to the same extent, right? So it's, there's nothing really inevitable about the situation that we're in. We just have to kind of like organize against it.
I have some follow-up questions with the assumption that maybe some of our listeners like are hearing some of these words for the first time. So if you could define gentrification in a Montreal sense, how would you answer that person?
We have a document called Our Basis of Unity, where we try, with Cœur de Lille, where we try and define gentrification. And so the way that we define it is as a pattern of disinvestment and reinvestment in boroughs across the city that's enabled by the state, property developers, landlords, and even wealthier tenants intent on cleaning up the neighborhood, quote unquote. The word itself derives from the term gentry, a class position which historically refers to well-bred or well-heeled Europeans who, while they did not necessarily possess titles, owned land and made most of their income from rent. The process of gentrification, therefore may express itself culturally or ideologically, and often its proponents will claim that gentrification is a social good that lowers crime rates and brings in a better quality of tenants. But its real purpose is to raise property values and attract higher rents while privatizing community infrastructure, giving more money and power to landowners and pushing poorer residents deeper into the margins. So that was quoted from Our Basis of Unity. So I guess one of the things is that I'd explain is that there's a process that happens in a lot of neighborhoods where because of like speculation on housing or because of like not even just speculation, but just like investment in housing, landlords will want to kind of like recuperate the money that they invested in the in housing by making the rents go up. And so this kind of in invest in that neighborhood, but in doing so, the kind of price out poorer tenants who are then forced to leave and are brought to other neighborhoods and pushed further out into the margins of a city. So it's something that people are kind of like very familiar with usually if they've lived in a city for a long time because they've seen it happen over and over. But if you're on the tenant side of it, the kind of like dynamics of it might look a little bit obscure. You might just see like, oh, well, the rents are going up, what's happening, you know? But as the rents go up, like there's all these kinds of like other ramifications and effects that come with it. And yeah, like poor people are kind of like brought into further out into the margins of neighborhoods, and gentrification kind of like tends to hit one neighborhood and then radiate outwards to all the other neighborhoods around it.
And when you say social housing, I know this is like it's like a program in the city, and I think it's a term that maybe some people know if they're working in housing, but maybe a listener doesn't know it. So could you define social housing as well?
Yeah, so social housing is kind of like state-subsidized, state-controlled housing stock, so that it's not subject to the same kind of like pattern of investment and reinvestment. It has like fixed prices, and that are usually more affordable. So social housing will be like often housing that is for people with low income, that people with low incomes can apply to as a kind of like poverty relief effort. Social housing is obviously a necessity to combat gentrification because it stops like the most dire consequences of it, which is that people actually become completely homeless, right? But social housing tends to be very popular among working people for that reason, but it's quite unpopular amongst politicians because it doesn't necessarily make up a lot of tax revenue, right? Like it doesn't make the property prices go up. It actually has like the opposite effect, right? Mm-hmm. Social housing sometimes has a kind of bad reputation because the like big social housing projects of like the 60s and 70s or whatever have been like left in disrepair by the state in different ways. So often you'll see people who have lived in social housing that might have like a negative experience of it. However, that's not inevitable. This has to do with how much the state is investing in social housing. We want to dream that it's possible, and we want to argue that it's possible to have well-maintained, beautiful social housing that people can live in. And we want to argue for that really strongly. The way that Cardelil articulates itself is that we're actually an anti-capitalist and anti-gentrification organization. So this is a crisis, but the preceding kind of like what was there before wasn't a just system in the first place, right? Like that we kind of like never had we always had kind of like homelessness under capitalism. It's kind of like a necessary component of it. But as exploitation gets more, exploitation kind of inevitably intensifies under capitalism. And so therefore we have to kind of dream up these situations and argue for and build these kind of this infrastructure and solutions that aren't capitalist, that we have to try and remove housing from the commodity market. Like we have to stop treating it like it's a commodity to benefit from, and rather that it's something that everyone should have.
We're talking right now on June 15th. July 1st is coming in Montreal. Can you define why July 1st is important in 2021 context, just from your vantage point?
So July 1st is moving day in Quebec, and traditionally it always was where like the large, I would say the majority of leases, or at least as far as I know, end on July 1st. I think if you talk to housing committees, it's pretty clear that there's been a much higher wave of evictions than usual, that that our systems are kind of completely overburdened. I would say that since the curfew kind of revealed this earlier, our shelter system is also overburdened, so that we have like these kind of this kind of domino effects coming up, where we know that a bunch of people are going to be homeless, but there's also not enough shelter in the first place for them. And so that this, you know, when I organized the town hall, I felt, you know, like we really need to understand that this is going to happen, and we need to be prepared for it, because everyone's already burnt out from dealing with the pandemic. Everyone, all our systems are already overtaxed. How are we going to deal with them being, you know, even more burdened by this crisis, right? Mm-hmm. I guess that's like why I wanted to underline that date. However, it's not the only date where we know that international students are going to be coming back on September 1st for Concordia and McGill, and, you know, presumably UQAM and UDEM as well. And they're going to find too that like a lot of like residences from universities are not working at full capacity, and that rents have soared. So that we're expecting that there's going to be more and more of like this demand for reasonably priced housing, and there's no reasonably priced housing to answer that demand. So people are going to be kind of forced into overcrowded housing, or even just forced to be homeless. I don't think it's right that people are making so much money off of human misery this way. But I hope that people are, you know, being thoughtful and are able to like organize against this. I think, you know, for example, I think I would encourage anyone that lives in a building to talk to their neighbors, and to maybe try and talk to their communities and to help each other out with this. I can't say that I can make a prediction in terms of like the political reaction to this. But I can say that we're headed for quite a large crisis, because again, rents have soared so much, and we already know kind of like we can already kind of see what's happening, right? I would argue that we need a very strong anti-capitalist response to this, and that means that we need a very concerted push that is coming from across the city, that people are, and across institutions and across sectors, and that people understand that it's workplaces also need to advocate for better housing. This is a workers' rights issue as much as it's anything else. That this is a women's issue as much as it's anything else. That gentrification is also has historically been this kind of white supremacist institution, right? Like that it's privileged, a certain class of people that's been historically constituted, right? Mm-hmm. That it's been very enmeshed in colonialism in the city as well. So I think it's we need to understand that like all of these like systems can already be so cruel in our city will get worse unless we're able to organize and challenge them. Right? Like that we can't just like let things go in a kind of like passive way, because otherwise this crisis is just going to affect people whether they like it or not.
What would you say to someone who's looking for an apartment right now for July 1st?
I'd say good luck, because honestly, I've known quite a few people in that situation, and it's incredibly stressful, right? Like I think people are kind of like forced into accepting rents that they might not otherwise accept, right? Like a lot of or accept kind of like living situations that they might not otherwise accept. I really hope that for example, more investment into social housing could help figure out some kind of solutions for this. I would say if you are looking for housing on July 1st and you're really out of luck, I would say, contact your local anti-gentrification or housing committee, anti-gentrification organizing station or housing committee, because like they might be able to direct you. A lot of them are overburdened. But I would say, you could also look for online, there's different kind of like housing groups that can help each other try and find safe housing. And there's also kind of like lease transfer networks. I still feel like we need kind of like more tools for that. One of the other things I would say is that I would encourage people to look up to see if they can find what the previous rent in their building was. There's a tool called the Mon Loyer that you can look up, and it's not posted for every building, but people are encouraged to kind of post what rent is in their building at that moment. And sometimes you'll be able to find out there haven't been any kind of like major renovations in the building and the rent has doubled, for example. And then sometimes you actually do have a case in front of the Tribunal Administratif du Logement to get that rent reset. To try and, if that process seems overwhelming, it's because it's often better done with a, with people shouldering you. I guess those are some of like the tips I would give to people.
And as far as tips for someone who is searching for an apartment and doesn't want to gentrify, do you have any thoughts or tips about how they should hold both of those considerations?
Well, I actually think, it's always something that has kind of like bothered me, is that there's a lot of like the idea that like wealthy tenants or like this like these kind of like wealthy tenants that are enacting gentrification, right? Mm-hmm. Because if you're a poor tenant, chances are you just like kind of like see a bunch of rich people coming in your neighborhood and you're like, gentrification is a bunch of rich people coming in my neighborhood, right? Mm-hmm. But like what's actually happening is this pattern of like kind of like rich people investing in housing. and the difference, so, so it's, So this is kind of like, if things get kind of like topsy-turvy in that way, where I think people blame kind of like other tenants for the gentrification when it might not actually be the case. But yeah, if you're a tenant that's looking for a new lease and you feel forced to accept like something that's like too expensive, yeah, again, like you might want to look to see if the rents were illegally raised higher and think, well, if you're able to lower the rent for your building, this is good for everyone, right? Because then, you know, you give kind of like more of a chance for other people to get into that housing. I would say, you know, also like you want to support any kind of local initiatives around you for social housing and be very vocal about this and make sure that like politicians that promise that they're going to do to, you know, invest in social housing do so, and that the initiatives that to build social housing are transparent, because often they aren't, and a lot of buildings a lot of like the kind of meetings about this are done in a transparent way. So like having kind of like more community, arguing for more community control over social housing is another thing that people can kind of do to help like their neighborhoods resist that gentrification. I would say like, I would mainly actually encourage just people to get involved rather than just think of it just as like, an income level kind of like thing, right? Like to try and just like think politically about like the kind of like larger relationships at hand and the larger like property relationships at hand. Because it's like, you know, for example, like gentrification often happens when a major industry moves into a neighborhood where suddenly, you know, like housing that is near that major industry becomes much more in demand. And because it's much more in demand, people can kind of like raise rent and make more money off those buildings. And then, you know, like the rent, like the property prices go up as well. There's people who are like the landlords who are making money off of this are making much more money. Like it, you know, it's... The difference between like the average landlord that's making money off of this and like even the quote unquote kind of like wealthier tenant is like much larger than the difference between, you know, a more well-off tenant and a poor person, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like to kind of like understand that too. It's that like if you're a tenant that's kind of like has it a little bit easier and that's not under threat, it's that you have to have solidarity with people who are worse off than you. You have to understand that like people are really roughing it, and that it's in your interest, you know, it's in your interest to actually band together with people who have it worse off than you. I guess that I would put it that way.
How do people find the Refuse Your Rent website?
It's on os.caudelille.org. HAUSSE Caudelille altogether, CAUDELILLE.org. You can just enter a couple of things, including like the school tax for your building, and the municipal tax for your building, and it will automatically calculate what your rent increase should be. When I plugged in like the values for my building, for example, I actually came up with a negative value. So that does happen sometimes.
Mm-hmm. What does that tell you with a negative value?
I think it means that the increases that are happening aren't based on anything other than the landlords just like systematically doing this to make more money, right? Like it's not based on their property taxes going up necessarily even, right?
Carl, what did I not ask you that I should have asked you in this time that we're having this conversation about Coeur d'Alene?
You know, Coeur d'Alene, we're an organization that aims to decommodify housing, as I've said, and to kind of like help tenants enforce their rights, and we do so as workers and tenants ourselves. So we're not an NGO. We're not publicly funded. We're actually a group of people that just are fighting against gentrification because we understand that it's in our own interest to do so. So, you know, if people want to get involved, I would absolutely say that they should, you know, email us, because we will respond, right? Mm-hmm. Or to email us if they're kind of having problems and they're in the area. The other thing is that, you know, any organization or group of people that's like kind of like interested in fighting gentrification and organizing against this crisis, you know, I encourage them to email organisonsensemble@protonmail.com, which is the kind of email that we've made for the town halls that we're organizing. Because to just kind of like explain to us, you know, who they are and what their stake in this, the stake is. I think the more the merrier, you know, if there are tenants or workers that are kind of like interested in fighting this, we'd love to have them on board. I think, you know, like one of the last things that I'd like to stress, because I suppose I've only kind of like broached it, but like, you know, in our analysis, like I would like to make it clear that like there's like some, like the commodification of housing and housing being kind of like seen as a commodity, and land being seen as a commodity in Canada, you know, it's been a deeply violent process, and it's been a process of dispossession as well. That's, I think, really disproportionately impacted Indigenous people. It's you know, really wrapped up in a lot of violence. I think, you know, we need to like kind of like think about this stuff seriously, and not to think about it as just like these kind of like neutral numbers floating around in the air. I think there's been a lot of like really serious tragedy that we've seen happen in our city. Because of the speculation, because of property prices going up, and because of this kind of commodification. And I think people are exhausted, and I think the human toll of it is really great. I suppose those are like things that I would like to stress. You know, we see that like a lot of like the increase of policing that comes out of like wanting to protect private property has a huge human cost. And it's awful. And I wish there was more political traction in really combating these issues in a concerted way, rather than kind of like constantly brushing them to the side or acting, you know, like, oh, gentrification benefits some people and it doesn't benefit other people. Well, we see that, you know, it makes life worse for the most vulnerable members of our society. And that these inequalities, they're not, you know, natural things. They're things that are reproduced and recreated at the benefit of some members of our society. And I just think, yeah, I'm sorry. Like, I guess it's like I wanted to try and capture the scale of it, you know, and I want to capture the fact that it doesn't impact everyone equally. It doesn't impact people justly. It really creates, reinforces these like really deep and violent systems of inequality. And I encourage for people to be making these connections, and to be understanding how much like, you know, our mutual survival is embedded in each other, you know, that like we can't just like make part of the population disposable through this kind of like property prices going up. But that's exactly what's happening. I think it's more common for people to just look at poverty and think that this is kind of like this inevitable thing, or look at homelessness and think that it's this inevitable thing, or even ascribe this kind of like moral character to it, where they think that, you know, like poor people aren't working hard enough, or that homeless people aren't working hard enough, and that's why I didn't make it. But, you know, what we understand is that like property, like housing, is mostly transmitted through family. Right, like it's mostly not earned in any kind of way, but it's transmitted, and so I think when we have to like, I think we have to think about like more redistributive systems and more just systems that we could be building, where we value human life as a matter of course, and that we don't dehumanize people in this kind of routine way, and that we don't take it for granted that a part of the population has to be made vulnerable and humiliated and dehumanized for human profit. And I think to understand too that like people often like resist the idea of like, you know, giving handouts, right? Like this is often like the right wing argument, right? Like where it's, oh, well, you know, we don't want to like house homeless people because I didn't get a handout. Well, the majority of people who have a lot of money in society were given a handout by their family, for example. So like it's to kind of apply that logic. If you apply that logic fully, then you'd be like, well, maybe we all, you know, should have dignity in housing. Maybe none of us should be threatened with like, you know, death and homelessness if for example, we refuse to, you know, work or if we're unable to work. And to understand that like a lot of the factors that make people downwardly mobile are very cruel things, right? Like that, like things like domestic violence can make people downwardly mobile. And if we want to stop things like this, then we have to like start thinking of those systems as interconnected. That we have to think that like, no, we can't treat people like they're disposable and we shouldn't. And that requires, you know, like funding, like, you know, creating these kind of like common spaces for people to refuse that everything gets privatized, that everything, that there's always more austerity. And it's also to understand that, like, you know, if property prices go up and homelessness goes up, that people are, you know, more vulnerable at their jobs, that you know, that it has a negative impact on working people. Like, even if you're like someone who's making minimum wage, you know, like, you might actually experience more coercion and like at work because property prices go up, even if your lease is fine.
They said Kudalil is still holding town halls in the future to find long-term solutions to a long-lasting problem.
Yeah, so we're on Twitter. I believe our handle is @Kudalil. And I believe we have Instagram. And we can be reached at gentrification@kudalil.org. And we also have the website is kudalil.org. So that's kudelille.org.
Before we go, some news that you can use. July 1st is coming. It's the biggest move-in day all year, and many residents and activists say mass evictions are on their way. Montreal says people who expect to be unhoused or homeless on July 1st should call 311. The province is offering all full-time students money after a COVID school year. Students who are enrolled in Quebec schools can receive $100 per semester. Applications open on July 2nd, and you can find out more about eligibility at your school or at quebec.ca. And CKUT is gradually resuming some of our pre-pandemic activities. The station is still closed, but we'll eventually start broadcasting community events live. Check back with news at ckut.ca. And in lighter news, there will be a cooking demonstration hosted by the Museum of Jewish Montreal for Pride Month. The June 29th event is a virtual Pop-Tart cooking lesson with non-binary MasterChef Canada champion Jennifer Crawford. You can find out more on Instagram at MuseeMTLJuif. And that concludes this Friday's edition of Off the Hour, produced by Montreal's Community News Collective. The collective includes myself, Brian Jefferson, Alice Wu, Kate Addison, Joel Samadal, and Sarah Jesmer. For more information on anything you heard tonight, or if you would like to participate or support news produced by and for the Montreal community, please contact CKUT's Community News Department at 514-448-4041, extension 7000, or news intern at ckut.ca. Also, you can follow us on Instagram at Off the Hour, or connect with us on Facebook. Search for us on CKUT.
FM is proud to rebroadcast the following program entirely in the Mohawk language. The Mohawk, or Ganyatgahaga, are the original people of the unceded traditional territory known as Montreal, or Chojaake. The Ganyatgahaga, or people of the Flint, have two communities close by, and they are working hard at revitalizing their language. This program is part of those efforts, and it originally aired in Ganasadage on RKR, reviving Ganasadage Radio. And now, listen to Jojage's Indigenous Language on CKUT.
Sego ganasada gherono wat kwana horado onare giga zawada hunsa dai idano wahni dio da yakini taru wa wahni zarate owaraga nagadi nana na da haswate tani waksanota dana zawada hunsa dana oska de wa nyawar oska yo jisto kure zada fm onagi tonizi antkadasone agwego wat kwana horado Ayamas ayazawada geritanyu ge danoskana ayazawana tanyu haga. Daga ayagini gwene neonjira zesa ayajano tanyu hae tena uamahni zarade agwatni gunhurori. Ayamas ki ayagini gwene ayajadariyan datsari na hota. Agwego kui watkwana hurada ayamas ki skana ayazawahni zarukta uamahni zarade. Tanayatun haga nezawatni gunhura. Onagi yasiya jehta neonjira zesa. To tansko de titono se de jera zesa wahne dio da hadin a horada wara gana gadi.
Arats kunyo go aona aona gadi tia guaki net kawana yeris ne wase wano het steyo wana na won swahi guaki ne yo yanerde neki ont kajero teki nise ne to gun murado ne momniserda da yaos tisa da gadi de ki wahi tinises. Ayamos tiagwe ki ne yo yana rajedan oni ne agoros o ne ne ron adams de ne umamuni serdade don ken mwerado. Ayamos ti so wada agarite ni nise agwe ki ne.